Welcome to episode 40 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Sarah Horowitz, a printmaker based in Leavenworth, Washington, who also makes drawings and artist books. We talk about how her parents fostered her artistic interests by always providing her with access to materials and art classes as she was growing up. Sarah attended Hampshire College in Massachusetts, where she ended up focusing on printmaking. After college, she honed her printmaking skills at studios in Switzerland and Scotland before returning to the Northeast, where she got involved with the book arts community. Eventually, she ended up on the West Coast when she was looking for a community print shop to work in. She tells me how she discovered there were more papers to print on than Reeves BFK, and we discuss one of her artist book projects in detail, which involved custom handmade paper. Sarah talks about the reciprocal process of printing on paper, as she explores how the paper responds to her imagery and the ink, and how her plates print on the surface of the sheet. We also have a long discussion about how she pigments and sizes Japanese papers to obtain the exact colors she wants, and the tooth that allows her pen to glide smoothly across the surface for her drawings. Enjoy our conversation. Sarah Horowitz, welcome to Paper Talk. We've been talking to each other for many years. We met in Portland, and then I moved, and now you've moved, and we've been having a conversation about our businesses. We've been accountability buddies for, I'm going to say, 6 years.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So I think we both did a couple of coaching sessions with Carolyn Campbell in Portland. And I've done other coaching and learned about having a business partner just to keep myself accountable. It's really hard as an artist to figure things out, and Sometimes I just tell you something I want to be held accountable for. Other times I'm asking you questions.
And I've been through huge life changes, having a kid.
Right.
Moving as well. And so it's nice to have a constant touch point in talking to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's been a real pleasure to have had this long relationship. And we also share the same birthday, which is really funny.
In 2 days,
May 9th. And I don't think I've had a birthday buddy before. So yeah, I want to hear a little bit about your beginnings with art. Like, were you artistic as a child? Did you draw? That's your main medium, I think.
Yeah, I drew my entire life. My parents have a few drawings from when I was 3, and they decide I was brilliant or something. And the piece that when I was 5 or 6 got put in a museum show of a bird. And so they were extremely supportive, always gave me art classes, that kind of thing, and gave me opportunities to draw and materials, having that around. And art was just a part of life. My mom was always interested in art. Her family, that was something that they always respected, and then lots of friends that were artists. So drawing and expressing oneself through a visual medium or other kinds of arts was just part of it. And so I've always drawn, and it was always supported.
That's wonderful. And so you're saying that your parents thought you were brilliant. So what did the drawing look like? And I want to hear about that museum show as a 5-year-old.
I vaguely remember the drawing. It was like a giraffe and some trees bending over. And it just had lots of different elements in it. It was very fleshed out with all kinds of animals and trees. And the museum drawing was a bird that I'd drawn. I actually haven't drawn birds a whole lot until very recently, but it was a little bird.
And what museum? Where were you living?
We were in Memphis, Tennessee. Okay. I don't remember the museum. It was definitely some sort of show where they were intentionally including kids.
Right.
Either through the school or through some other program that we participated in. And I'm sure they framed and submitted my work in an effort to support me and my enthusiasm. You know, always gave me the opportunity to take art classes. And when we lived in D.C. or D.C. area, about when I was 15, I'd take the metro downtown and go meet with a teacher and learned watercolors and more drawing techniques, that kind of thing.
Okay. And then I know you went to Hampshire College, which is kind of a mm-hmm. school. I want you to tell me a little bit about that and how your studies evolved.
Hampshire is, it's in Amherst, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And it's a school where you only get grades and, opposite. You don't get grades, you only get evaluations. And you work with professors, you build committees for what you want to do and work out a plan with them and describe your project and then have to work through that and be resourceful to make your project happen.
Did you know that you had a project in mind when you first went, or do you kind of?
No, I went there just in order to learn.
Okay.
I didn't want a typical university experience because I wanted to learn. I wanted the potential to just explore, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. Uh-huh. I'd always liked doing art, but I didn't want to pigeonhole myself. So I went into it, started off with an orientation of canoeing. Uh-huh. And then I took all kinds of classes, particularly literature, writing, Jewish history, and I took math classes. I also tried to take the art classes, but the intro art classes, and at this point, I'd actually already taken class at Glazell School of Art during high school. It's in Houston, Texas, mm-hmm. And it's an art college, but I took evening classes there. The intro classes at Hampshire were, you know, your basic drawing and painting, and there's a pepper on the stand, that kind of thing. And I wasn't very interested. I'd done it, and the classes were really, really full. Okay. Huge, overfilled, 40 kids trying to get into the class. And so I just wasn't that interested. I felt like I'd done it. And the math classes and physics classes with a couple professors who were just fabulous were much more intriguing to me. So I just kept taking math and physics classes. There were four professors, that were just extremely invested in their students, uh-huh. thought outside the box. They wanted to spend time outside. They wanted to look at nature as a way of getting to math and physics. They were interested in language and writing about one's work as well. So very out-of-the-box thinkers and open to however you wanted to approach it, at the same time still being rigorous.
Uh-huh. And didn't one of these math professors have an influence on you?
Yeah. Ken Hoffman was very intrigued with his natural environment and studied the area. So he did tree identifying walks, nature walks, every Wednesday morning at 7 or 7:30, which was really early for me at the time. as a college student. But every Wednesday we'd meet outside the science building bright and early, and we'd walk around campus, which had acres of trees and old forests, and we'd look at types of trees, plants, the whole ecology of the system. So what was growing where and why, things like what was on the understory and why it wasn't growing higher because of what was above it, or the history of Dutch elms disease or the chestnut blight that wiped out the original chestnut forests in that area. And so how the landscape had changed based on the flora in the area.
Right. And so you weren't taking art classes. How did you sort of get back into art making?
I wasn't taking art classes. I think I took one here and there. I started drawing the plants and in order to learn them. I thought that'd be a great idea. And that way I'd learn the plants more. And so I started doing just ink and pencil, ink, watercolor sketches of plants. And they came out great. I really liked them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I sort of hit a block in math and physics where my prospects were to, you know, delve further in and eventually go for being a professor or working for a company in terms of engineering or math innovation, that kind of thing. And my heart wasn't in it. I just didn't know where I wanted to go with it. I kind of got stuck. And I had a term where I didn't know what I wanted to do. So that summer I went to Chautauqua School of Art, which is a rigorous art camp, and learned. I took classes in drawing, painting were the basis everybody had to take. And then you had an elective, and I took some ceramics and printmaking, woodcuts and etching. Mm-hmm. And that blew me away. And I came back and said, okay, I'm finishing with a thesis in printmaking, and had to convince my professors that I could do a full U-turn and that I had enough art classes from my here and there dabbling to do that.
Junior, or what year was this?
I think I was at the end of my junior year, and I went to Chautauqua that summer. Okay. And then went into my senior year and did this about face, which doesn't feel like an entirely different subject to me. You know, I'm involving everything I'd learned in my art at that point, and that wasn't leaving it, more building on it.
Right, right. And so what was your thesis project, and what about equipment, or did you just do drawings? Did you mm-hmm. continue printmaking?
No, I went for printmaking. Completely. I had some huge idea about some sculpture, about movement, and my professors very realistically said that that didn't make a lot of sense, and I couldn't try and do everything in the world, and I had to pick one thing. Mm-hmm. And so the one thing I picked was my printmaking class. Okay. And it was a printmaking class at Smith College. So Hampshire College is part of the five college consortium with UMass, Amherst, Mount Holyoke, and Smith, and you can take classes at any of the schools. So since Hampshire no longer had a full printmaking studio, they didn't have presses, I took classes at Smith, Mount Holyoke, and UMass. And I was taking a class at Smith. It was fantastic. It was etchings primarily. And my thesis ended up being a series of etchings based on sunflowers. And Hampshire has a garden, has a CSA and a farm, and they grew lots of sunflowers, and fall comes early, winter comes early in Massachusetts. And I was able to go pick the dead sunflowers from the field. And that's what I drew and made etchings of. And a couple woodcuts, but pretty much etchings. And ended up having a show in the gallery at Hampshire of about 17 pieces.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so then what happened after graduation?
I ended up staying in the area right towards the, I can't remember if, I think it was after I graduated, I started getting to know, and around the time of graduation, I started to getting to know the book arts community in the area. Then I left town. I went to Switzerland for the summer to do more printmaking. My mom is Swiss and grew up in Basel, and her mom knew of somebody who knew somebody, which is how it always works, that had a printmaking studio and taught students. So I ended up in outside Bern in Münchingen with a teacher named Hans-Jörg Brunnen, mm-hmm. Brunner, and he took students in his studio several days a week and taught printmaking, etching. So I went there, had a very rigorous course in very old school printmaking, which was things like pretty toxic processes, like polishing your tools with kerosene instead of just a mineral oil, you know, dipping your hands fully in it. There were some translation issues. I speak the dialect, Swiss German, so I was able to communicate, but there's some technical words that took me a little while to get, and I finally realized I was dunking my hands daily in kerosene. Or aqua tints using ground up asphaltum, which is extremely carcinogenic. We mostly use rosin, and the non-toxic shops will use a spray-on acrylic. But we used the ground asphaltum, and the print shop was literally in the kitchen. So
you might have been eating those chemicals too.
We might have been eating them too. It was a couple months, and I was there and got a really, really solid foundation, though, in how to wipe a plate, how to prep a plate, how to etch a plate beautifully. But actually, before that, put on the ground, roll on the ground, smoke the plate, which is using a taper to burn the ground so it's black because it's very thin. Etch it beautifully so it's super sharp and clear. We used ferric chloride, which is actually less toxic as long as you don't eat it. And then wiping a plate, hand wiping a plate. And I hadn't learned how to properly do that really, really well and really nicely in terms of wiping a plate. So got a really good foundation in making beautiful etchings. And then I went to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Printmakers Workshop, which is the opposite. It's a non-toxic shop in Edinburgh. And just a fantastic place with people from all over the world making prints, and they have everything. They have the photo plate processes. They have litho, woodcuts, and etching, all non-toxic processes, along with the art gallery, and had some great teachers there. But that was more just you have time to work, and there's some master printers around who will assist you if you need help with processes. So I was there for a while and ended up back in Massachusetts to keep making etchings.
Okay, and let's talk about, because this is paper talk, the early papers you were printing on.
Uh-huh. Well, it's funny because my paper world has gone from very narrow to expanding massively. Back then it was, well, everybody just uses BFK, Reeves BFK, mm-hmm. and that was it. And you had to get big zinc plates from the UMass supply store. Mm-hmm. So Reeves BFK was the be all end all. That's what you bought. I was horrified that paper cost $2 a sheet back then because it just seemed so expensive. And there didn't seem to be anything else available. As I started working, I started finding out about various papers like Arsch, or Magnani, the Italian papers. But it wasn't until I got into the book world, after I came back to Massachusetts and started getting to know Michael Kutch, who had been an apprentice of Leonard Baskin, actually met Leonard Baskin, and that whole book world, that I found out about handmade papers. Because Michael, I wanted to make my own book, having seen these amazing books, and Michael said, well, you can't use that, but I'm going to be ordering some paper from, I think it was Zecchi paper from Florence. So I'm going to be ordering some of this handmade paper. Do you want some?
So he told you can't use the
BFK. I couldn't use the BFK. Okay. It wasn't original enough. It wasn't interesting enough. Yeah. It didn't print well enough. And since I was putting in this order, did I want some paper? And so I think I ordered maybe just 20 sheets, maybe 100, probably not 100. I probably didn't have the budget for that. I might have just gone for 20 sheets because I could quarter them and get 4 out of each. Right. So it was Zecchi from Florence. And so that was the start of my paper explorations.
Right. So you dove right into printing, started making books right after college?
Pretty much. First in Switzerland and Edinburgh, where I learned different techniques, and then back in Northampton because there's this amazing book arts and printmaking community and lots of studios and that kind of thing. And I worked with a bookbinder and binding his books for a short period of time. And but he was high on pot all the time. And it wasn't a very good working experience. But basically just kept making my work. I used the UMass studio for print shop and started exploring making books.
Okay, and I know you moved to Portland shortly thereafter. How did you, was that mm-hmm. job related or?
It was mostly print shop related.
Okay.
I needed a place where I could keep working, where I could have a printmaking studio, and Boston and New York were prohibitively expensive. So I thought I'd go to California. I had a friend in Oakland, and I found the Kala Art Institute. Mm-hmm. Wanted to work there, but you had to apply, or if you didn't get a fellowship, it was quite a lot. At the time, it was $300 to be a member. But a connection from Massachusetts knew somebody in Portland who had a printmaking studio, and after it was the beginning of the tech bubble in the Berkeley area. So around 2000, uh-huh. and I couldn't find a place to live. I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have a regular job. So I couldn't get an apartment and I couldn't afford the print shop and I didn't get the fellowship. And so I followed up those leads for Portland, had another friend there, called the guy who had the print shop. And he said, yeah, we got a space, rent's $85 a month, and you got to know what you're doing.
Ah.
And I said, I did. I'd show up with a portfolio, and somebody loaned me a bike. So I'm biking all the way from northeast to southeast Portland with a huge portfolio. Uh-huh. I thought I'd die on that bike ride. And they said, yeah, you just take 20th down, and it's just a few blocks. Here's all the major streets. Right. And I showed up, showed my portfolio. He said, here's a key and here's how it works. Have fun. And I was there for the next 14 years.
Cool. And that, what's the name of that studio? It's still there?
It's still there. It's Atelier Mars and it's run by Tom Prochaska. Mm-hmm. Kim Osgood is still there. Martha Fan Schmidt, I think, is still connected. She was running it at the time as well, and a few other artists. So printmaking was actually a really good way into book arts and paper because it's a cooperative. It's a way you end up working cooperatively a lot since nobody owns their own equipment.
Right.
So you have to work with other people in various shops and share things. And so you have this collaborative and this ongoing conversation with people of how do I do this? How do I do that? How do I make this and that work? And so you get a lot more resources than you would have otherwise.
Right. That's really cool. And I imagine you got connected to the community in Portland because of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I know you ended up teaching some at PSU.
Yeah, and then that was through Tom and Christy Wyckoff, old-time printmakers in Portland, who, when they were looking for a printmaker to teach at Portland State, they said, oh, call Sarah. Uh-huh. And it wasn't about, like, oh, let me see your they actually didn't ask me for a resume until after I was teaching. Oh, by the way, we should have your resume on file. Right. And so I submitted that, but it was mostly because they just recommended me. Mm-hmm. So
Okay, well, I want to talk more about the papers you use and why you choose certain ones for particular projects.
Yeah.
I know you've made many artist books now. You touched on that, but talk about one of your books and sort of the choices.
Right. So I've kept making books. I was thinking, you know, because you mentioned that about the books. I was thinking about my moth book, about Lepidoptera, as a book where paper was a huge factor. Paper's a factor in all of them, not just like how does it print or how does it look, but it's really about the feel of the paper. Like how does the paper, the paper is the essence of the book. So you can put images on it, you can make it colorful or not, or have text. But if it's thick and heavy or really light and flexible, mm-hmm. the paper gives the book its entire feel. So it doesn't matter what you do, whether it's handmade and fancy or machine made. I used Kozo Japanese mulberry paper for one of my first books because it was about poppies. And so the feel of the paper was echoing how I felt about the plant. But this book, Lepidoptera, I ended up working with Katie McGregor on the book, and she made the paper for the book. And one of the main reasons was that I wanted it to be gray, and I couldn't find the right gray paper. I had some samples of old papers, antique papers, that were this beautiful, slightly warm gray color. But when I looked for gray papers, and I looked at, you know, Arsh and... I use a lot of Hanamuli paper as just a staple paper. Now I use a lot of Zirkal, works really well as a factory mold-made paper. They didn't have the right gray. So I wrote to Katie, I sent her some of my little samples, and she made color samples, sent me back these little squares of color samples. And Lepidoptera is moths and butterflies. So the book was a book of moths. And while there's actually lots of colorful moths, this gray color was just something I'd been wanting to use for a long time and was about the feeling of moths for me. Mm-hmm. So Katie sent me all these samples, and I picked out a couple, and she made the paper. I ended up liking the colors so much that we used the darker paper she made for the end sheets, and that was the basis of the book.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I wanted to let you know about a new program over here at Helen Hebert Studio. I've started a free Facebook group called Club Paper. It's a place to share what you're working on, get encouragement when you need a little push, be inspired with new ideas, tips, tricks, books, and supplies, all having to do with paper. I hope to create a place over there where we feel like we're in a clubhouse working on projects and having a conversation together. We're building a paper community, one sheet at a time. Join us by going to Facebook and searching for the group Club Paper. Now back to the episode.
Okay, and what fiber content do you know?
I think it was mostly cotton paper. She uses... some linen and flax as well. She doesn't really use abaca. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. As a printmaker, it's all about what I can print on. And this gray paper printed beautifully. And I've actually been struggling with some of her white papers. And we're thinking it might be because of the pigment content. But she also changed sizing in the meantime. And so it's always this puzzle, which I love. Of figuring out, okay, what's the fibers? How much pigment is in this? What's the sizing? And how does that affect my printing? And there's never a bad result. It's always just a problem solving. How can I make this work? And how does this make it more interesting? So sometimes, like with the Wildflower book, she made the paper for that. And the paper didn't take the ink as well, but it ended up giving it actually a more delicate quality. And when I printed proofs on a Hanamuli paper, which just takes heaps of ink, they came out too dark, actually. So I was working and making prints for that paper. And so it's this very reciprocal relationship of making images, how they print, and then how the paper responds to the ink and the color and the different surfaces.
Right. And you mentioned that you usually test a couple of papers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
How did you come to knowing the gray Katie McGregor paper? Did you test other ones or had you?
Michael Kutch.
Yeah.
He shows up at various points in my life. He's a good person to bounce ideas off of. I was looking for handmade paper. Mm-hmm. He had just been working on a book with Tupont's Press, Kensher and Lee Rockefeller's Press, mm-hmm. Called The Little River, which is a Margaret Weiss Brown, and used this beautiful handmade paper. And he said, it prints like a dream. Mm-hmm. Call Katie. So it was this entire word of mouth thing. She didn't have a website. She's up far north. And I gave her a call, and she was able to potentially make something for me. So she sent me some samples, and I was comparing some mold-made papers and other options.
So she sent you just some white samples?
I think a dark green. She had a sheet of dark green. She had some white. Yeah, just random. I'm
familiar with her paper.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Various sheets. She sent me I had a little booklet paper. I think Barb Tettenbaum had mentioned her to me years ago. So it was sort of coming back.
Right.
I had these little samples, little sample booklet, but her paper had changed because she just makes what she needs to make or wants to make. So she didn't have a catalog or anything per se, and the samples were really old. So she just sent me some sheets, and I printed on them and was blown away. So it was a good weight. I just sort of described the weight. It's a book. Should be about this, which is frequently how it ends up working. It's just sort of a description, and then somebody who knows the medium really well has a really good sense of how best to make the paper for that. And then the gray was my idea. I just sent her samples and said, can you make me gray? And she said, sure, let's figure this out.
Right. And describe the finished book to me. And I want to hear just a touch on about the printing process when you mm-hmm. when you pull an etching. Is that what you say?
Right. Yeah, you pull an etching. So the final book is a book with vellum cover. Vellum, fairly thin boards with a vellum wrap by Claudia Cohen, and gold foil stamping of Claudia, a moth on the cover.
The bookbinder.
Yeah, Claudia's the bookbinder. She made, I think the case, now I'm starting to forget actually what color the case is, but a linen-y case. And she was excited to work with this paper as well. Then it has an essay by Virginia Woolf called The Death of the Moth. So the essay is a two-page essay about life, sort of the existential question, this moth that's thriving and then eventually just loses its spark, its energy, and she can tell it's dying. And it's over the course of the day, so it also follows the curve and the peak of the morning, and then the height of the noon, and then sort of the dropping off of the day. Mm. And so I got permission to use the essay and printed a series of about 20 moths. Actually, I think there were more. I think there were 30 moths in the book. And so I printed the whole edition, pulled all the prints, and worked with Art Larson to print the text.
Okay, so the text is letterpress?
Text is letterpress. I use polymer plates.
Okay.
For all the printing, because it gives a huge amount of flexibility. We actually tried to use some boundary type, and there it was just not well, that set had a whole bunch of issues. So we ended up going with polymer plates by Boxcar Press, who always do a fantastic job.
And how many are in this edition?
40. So at this point, I've been capping them at 40. Sometimes I make a few less, but 40 is an amount that I don't end up stuck with heaps of books, which obviously cost a lot to make, are an investment in materials and time and effort. So I don't end up with heaps of them around, can sell them fairly quickly, and yet there's still a good return on my effort. So about 40.
Right. And I think I read that this edition is sold out.
Yes.
Is that right?
That is correct.
Well, you sell to private clients?
Some private clients, mostly university and libraries. There's a sort of this niche for book artists of universities and libraries who buy artist books. They're looking for works that fit their collection. Right. But then they're very interested in exploring new work that's being made.
Yeah. I want to come back to that, sort of how you sell your work. But I wanted to go back to colored paper, because I know that you actually color paper as well.
Mm-hmm.
You apply color, like indigo, and you can tell me more. And then sizing. And how did you get into all of that?
The drawing with dyeing and sizing paper came after printmaking. So printmaking is my touchstone for drawing, because I have to draw on metal plates, and that was sort of my grounding place. But I wanted to draw with ink on paper. I was doing a lot of pencil. I did a little bit of silver point, where I was prepping my own paper with chalk and animal skin glue to create my own gesso. And I was talking to, I think it was Rick Bartow at Frolic Gallery. We were both represented by Frolic Gallery, and I also worked there for a period of time. And I went with one of the directors at the time out to the coast to pick up some work from Rick. And he lives out in Newport, Oregon, lived. He passed away a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And he's just one of the most generous people I've ever known. He is so giving of his knowledge and his belongings, his materials. So he wanted to show me paper and drawings and this and that. And we were at one of the studios, and he had this collection of studios. One was an Airstream trailer with press in it. No, there was a shack where he did pastels, and then there was this other house where he had these flat files, and we were here and there picking up work from him. He said, "Oh, you got to come over here. Let me give you some paper. This is paper I got from Japan." Uh-huh. And this was really my entry into interesting Japanese papers and handmade papers, even more than with the books. I was working more with Western papers, and I was familiar with Kozo, and I was using some Japanese papers, but I wasn't really experimenting. And he had this drawer full of paper that he got from a paper shop called Paper Now, NAO. Mm-hmm. And he'd gone to Japan a few times, but also worked with Seiichi, who was a printmaker in Japan. Who also worked with Frolic Gallery. So he pulls out this paper that's coated with kakishibu, the fermented unripe persimmon juice.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a dark red brown. And that and some other sheets of paper. Take it back to the studio and try drawing on it. And unlike every other sheet of paper I've ever tried to draw on, even Western papers, which are okay for working with pen and ink, this worked beautifully. I just got the best line. And I'm working with a dip pen, a nib, and Sumi ink. So a jug of ink and a dip pen. Right. And usually you get like, it feels like trying to draw on a napkin. It's rough. It's fuzzy. It's textured. It absorbs the ink. It bleeds all over. Even Western papers, the fibers kind of catch on your nib. So this worked just amazingly. And then I found out that Hiromi Paper International in California, which is where I've been getting Kozo and paper for Chincolets for years, that they actually sell a jug of this stuff. So I started ordering paper and coating all my paper with the Kakishibu, which led me to these inquiries of, okay, I'm coating my paper with this substance that literally is sort of like a gel, like a gelatin. It, even if you leave the jug too long, it actually turns into sort of a jelly substance. Yeah. If you forget to use it. And so I was trying to figure out other ways I could coat my paper. And that's sort of what gave me that first clue that, oh, I can work with this if I coat my paper properly. And I started looking into it and I found the Japanese dosa. And it's a combination of basically, it's like animal skin glue, alum, and seaweed. And I'm not exactly sure of what all the ingredients are, but I got it from McLean's Printmaking and they have it powdered. You can also stick a piece of, I think it's kombu, the seaweed, in there, dissolve that in it. And you have to mix it on a double boiler, slowly heating it up and getting everything to dissolve properly. And then you can coat your paper with that. And it's beautiful and it works wonderfully. So I started using that.
Let me stop you and ask you the reason to coat the paper, which, so you started out with already coated paper, but is to prevent the ink from bleeding in too much.
Exactly. Yeah. And to have a crisp drawing surface.
Right.
And the problem with the Kakishibu is that it's always going to be red brown.
Right.
Yeah. Apparently they use it on umbrellas and on food for wrap. Yeah. It waterproofs things.
So the dosa is clear.
The dosa is clear. And so it gave me a lot more flexibility about color. So because the dosa is clear, I was making ink at the time. So I would coat paper with walnut ink that I'd made because I had jugs of the stuff. Also with iron gall ink and had a jug of that. And that makes it sort of a grayish blackish color. But those are all dyes and they don't seal the surface of the paper. So I would dye the paper and then coat it with dosa. And that would give me a surface I could draw on. I since had some conversation where somebody mentioned just getting a big bag of gelatin from an art supply place. It was probably New York Central. And that got me thinking about gelatin, which is related to animal skin glue, which is also what's used in priming canvases. And at a certain point, somehow I got turned on to the idea of using Knox's flavorless gelatin, which requires a cup of hot water and a little packet. And you have, in 2 minutes, you have sizing. So I have switched using Knox's flavorless gelatin. And I still dye the paper, but I use pigments a lot more of the time than I do dyes, just because of the colors I want to get, things like blues. Colors that where a dye would an ink or a dye would not necessarily be light fast enough.
Right.
And it's important to use pigments.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that light fast because dyes typically are not. And so what kind of pigments are you using?
Powder. I'm just using the direct powdered pigments. Yeah.
And if you mix them with?
I mix them with a little bit of water. It's my very unscientific process of using a spoon and sort of making a paste out of it with a little bit of water and then adding the gelatin and hot water. Otherwise, you get a lot of blobs.
Okay, so you're pigmenting and gelatin.
At the same time.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Making a paste, adding the gelatin, then the hot water, then using the brush to thoroughly mix it and letting the gelatin cool a little bit. It starts to thicken. And then applying it to the paper as fast as possible, just with a brush.
Right. And you're usually creating a series of sheets of paper.
I try and do as many as I can at the same time. Because once you've got the paper out and the gelatin out and everything and you're making a big mess, you might as well do several. But I still get the paper from Hiromi. So they have these large sheets of Mitsumata. They're about 55 inches by 29 inches. And they're absolutely gorgeous. So sometimes I just work on them with just clear sizing, just the gelatin. Mm-hmm. And then I also dye them. But the paper has a beautiful quality. They have similar Kozos and other papers that are also handmade. But this is one of my favorites.
So let's go back to how you sell your work, because I think it's interesting that you create an artist book edition and then you create prints of some of the pages in the book more than I do. And then you also show your drawings and gallery. And then I know you have a dealer for your books.
Right. So those are, you know, I feel like I have lots of baskets with lots of eggs. Mm-hmm. So all the different ways I work, and there's threads that run throughout them. Mm-hmm. And when I used to teach at Portland State, I'd bring my books in. And students would ask all these questions. How'd you make that? How'd you do this and that? And then I'd ask them, okay, so nobody's asked me how much I charge for these, because they were terrified of, well, I can't ask that. And I wanted people to know how this works and how much things cost and that kind of thing, because that's the only way that other people learn and can get their work out there. But so I do, I sell, well, let's start with the books. I have some private clients that I have a relationship with and sell to directly. I work largely with Ken Scherer of Two Ponds Press, and he's been a dealer for years and years. He sold Leonard Baskin's books. He's represented a few other artists, including an artist out of England, Bob Wakefield, and Peter Bogardis in New York City. And he goes to collections and shows them work, brings work from Two Ponds Press, his own press, and travels around the country selling books, going to book fairs. I've had a really, and he's very good at developing relationships with curators and librarians as well as private collectors. So he is the main way I sell my artist books. I really enjoy going to book fairs with him and his wife, Liv, and helping sell my books.
Right. And it's, talk about the relationship. The financial relationship is very similar to a gallery.
It is. He takes 40%.
Okay, 40%.
Of the sale. I produce, you know, do all the production, pay for all the costs of production and materials for my books. And then we set a price together and he receives a 40% commission. One thing we're doing lately with my most recent book, which is the Vogel Totentanz, Bird Dance of Death, is that we've done a deluxe part of the edition. And that is one way for artists to get more money from their effort, because you're not actually producing a whole separate book. You charge more because you're doing a fancier binding, you're including an extra set of prints, but you don't actually have a whole lot. Your material costs and labor costs are a whole lot higher.
And so how many, is that an edition of 40 and then a certain number of deluxes? Or
it's the whole edition is an edition of 40 and the first five are deluxe. Okay. So Ken receives a 40% commission, he gets paid, and then sends me a check. A lot of people balk at paying a representative like 40 or 50%. I work with Frolic Gallery. They sell mostly drawings, some prints too, but they're more successful with the works on paper that are drawings on the wall. And they take 50% because they're putting in the effort to publicize and show my work and have the space. But
and
I have
care of the the business side.
Exactly. Exactly.
Make your work.
And so I made a choice at a certain point that I wanted to be able to make work and be a mom. And that even though I actually really like the business side of it and selling work, that I only have so much time. And I had to make a choice between all those things. And I decided to hand over the selling part. It's been a really productive relationship, as in they bring skills in terms of business to the table as well. So just like when I work with Katie McGregor and she knows way more about handmade papers than I do, and I can describe something and she can make it happen. Ken and Charles both have a different level of expertise than I have. At the same time, I still put a lot of effort into newsletters and getting work out there and a website and continuing to let people know what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's really important as an artist to have your own following too. Mm-hmm. I'll link to Sarah's website in the show notes. Okay, we need to wrap up, but I want to just talk about you moved to Washington State a few years ago and you acquired your own press at that time. So you have a Leonard Baskin press. Tell us about
that. Because my work was the last critique that Leonard Baskin critiqued before he passed away. He took a look at my etchings and very kindly gave it a big thumbs up and encouraged me to keep going, and I was doing interesting work. So Lisa Baskin has collected my artist books, and I ran into her at an artist book fair in New York at the Antiquarian Book Fair at the Armory, and happened to mention that I was looking for an etching press because I'm now in Leavenworth, Washington, where I, for the first time, don't have the opportunity to be part of a co-op printmaking studio. And she said, "Oh, well, we've got this one sitting in the barn. And I've been wanting somebody to use it, and I thought it would get used more, but it's not. And it needs a lot of work. But if you want to ship it out, you can have it." And so we have an exchange of that made that possible. But I ended up getting somebody to do a lot of refurbishing there on site to remove rust. The old Charles Brand presses, I think it's about a 1969 press, have a wear plate underneath the press bed that had warped and needed to be replaced, as well as all the rust removed and bearings replaced. So Joseph Rydell did a whole bunch of work on the press, got it ready for shipping, put it on skids, and found me a shipping company. And then it got freighted over to me, and we literally used forklifts and heavy-duty machinery and lifted this press into my studio. Pallet jacks, the works. It's been... Charles Brand presses are one of the best presses that have ever been made. They're heavily built, and they just run... They're workhorses, and they run so smoothly. And this press has been like no other. So in Portland, I worked on Ray Trail presses, which were locally made, and they work beautifully, but this press is more consistent and heavy duty than anything I've ever worked on. It's a lot closer to some of the European presses that were all iron. So now I'm printing on my Charles Brand Leonard Baskin's press in my studio. I'm actually going to be printing later today. You mentioned that I do extra editions from my books because I want people to be able to have a print, not just a book, because there's a huge price point difference. Mm-hmm. So actually that's what I'm doing later today, is I'm printing the individual editions of 5 for the Dance of Death book.
Okay, so 5 etchings from each
Of each plate. Exactly.
Very cool. And let's just wrap up with your drawing, because I know it's spring right now when we're recording this, and I know you like to draw things that are
Burning.
And so what are you working on now, and what paper are you drawing on?
I'm working on Okawara. I get it in huge rolls from Hiromi. It's a wonderfully consistent paper. I think that it's probably a machine-made paper because it's on a roll, and so it's very large and long. They do have handmade versions, but I use the machine-made Okawara. It's a little bit, it has a little bit of a natural tint and a little bit of a sheen. And it's because I'm working on the Yale, on a literature prize from the Beinecke Library. It's called the Wyndham Campbell Prize. And I make the actual physical award that recipients get. And they award 8 people each year for their potential in their work. So writers in the English language, writers in drama, poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, 2 each. And so I make, along with a bookbinder, a case, that a leather-bound case with a clasp. And then inside has a fold-out easel with an original drawing on the inside, and then calligraphied name and dedication to the writer. So we're in process of that. The cases and the easels are being made by Carolina Veenstra in Kingston. The calligraphy is, the sheets for calligraphy are on their way down to Maryland and Zornado in Portland. The clasps are being laser cut over in Wenatchee at this very moment. And I'm making drawings. So this time the theme is yellow. And we have yellow leather, and I've been drawing blossoms with the little yellow pollen dots. I also found the maple. I got on it early enough and was able to draw the maple blossoms, which are sort of a yellowy green. Yesterday I did some Oregon grape. And so it's the Okawara. I think it's some mulberry fiber. It might be a mix of fibers. I'm not entirely sure. And it's got a clear coat of gelatin on it. Because I'm actually using watercolor on this as well as ink, I do about 3 layers of the sizing. And I'm actually able to polish down the gelatin. So I apply it, and then as it's drying and less tacky, I actually polish it and wipe it down so that it's consistent and gets rid of any bubbles. And then I do that about 3 times as it's drying.
So with a rag, or what are you polishing with?
Paper towel.
Paper towel.
Yeah. Yeah. Rag would work too. Although you'd have to make sure it didn't leave colorful fibers if your rags are colorful. Uh-huh. But I actually polished down the paper. They're not as big as some of my drawing sheets, so it's easier for me to do that. Okawara is also very stable. The paper doesn't soak through the paper, the gelatin. So it's a lot easier to apply the gelatin and work with it. I think it's changed over the years, because some years it did soak through and the past several batches haven't. So it's always this juggle of how's it going to respond and what works.
And these are pretty small, what you're making.
Yeah, they're about 7 by 14 inches.
And you're picking and bringing them into your studio, or are you going?
Most of the time I pick the flowers. Mm-hmm. It's hard with the watercolor to work outside.
Right.
I could take an etching plate outside or a watercolor pad. Mm-hmm. But since the paper is so flexible, I'd really need a really good support, and I end up using the pen, the ink, the watercolors, all sort of simultaneously in coloring and inking various parts as I go. So it's easier to just work in the studio.
Right, right. Well, good luck with those drawings, and thanks so much for coming on Paper Talk and sharing your story, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert's studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon. There's a reason besides the season.